Hello and welcome to another episode of the Menswear Style Podcast. I'm your host, Pete Brooker. On this episode, I'm going to talk to Philip Start, owner of Mr. Start. They are specialists in casual tailoring and elegant styling. Philip Start and his team pride themselves on their love and knowledge of beautifully made menswear, and you can find out more about the brand and also shop the look through the website at mr-start.com. And here is Philip to tell the story of Mr. Start.
I started out when I was young, always liking fashion. I was always interested in fashion. And I traveled to, I emigrated to Canada when I was 18 and sort of messed around there, working lots of different jobs, but always loved fashion. And when I came back when I was about 20, I got a job in the King's Road as a shirt salesman in a place called the Village Gate Squire Shop. They had a chain of shops. I actually was in the Squire Shop. And within about six weeks, they made me the manager of the shop. And I absolutely loved it. I loved every minute of running the shop, working in it, and I worked my way up to be the general manager. But I really did love it, and I was given a fantastic opportunity by a guy called Jeffrey Quintner, who was one of the owners, who's quite famous for people of my generation. And often people say they were given an opportunity by one person that gave them that leg up. And I suppose that one person was Jeffrey Quintner. He promoted me to be a manager from a shirt salesman in 6 weeks. So he obviously saw a spark of something. And I absolutely loved doing it. So it was a very successful time for me, and I was very lucky. And I did quite well financially out of it. They paid me very well. And I had a fantastic time. And then I suppose when I was about 27, 28, I just sort of woke up one day and thought, I'd like to do something else. I'd like to start my own business. So 6 weeks later, 6 weeks again, I had my own business. I found a shop in Oxford Street, at the wrong end of Oxford Street, and I sort of did a combination of some of the things we did at the Village Gate and then some things that I felt I could improve. And one of those things really was bringing in brands that people really weren't aware of, from mainly from Italy. So famous brands like Stone Island, CP Company, some Giorgio Armani, Jean Paul Gaultier, things like that that we started selling in conjunction with my own brand, which it was really just an interpretation of all the things that I saw. And then I would travel to Italy probably every 6 weeks. I'd visit the factories I did business with, and then I'd take a car and try and find brands that nobody had ever heard of, which I'd go into small shops and look for brands, and I'd find where they were, and I'd go and visit them, and I'd bring them back. And then I actually became an agent at one time for a brand called Manuel Ritz Pipo, which I sold in the shop. So that was a sort of the history of Woodhouse, a combination of my own interpretation of brands, and which I manufactured myself, and interesting brands that I thought complemented it. So it's not really a potted history, this, is it? It's more of a...
No, it's fascinating. I was going to ask, I mean, you say like these famous brands like Stone Island, for example. I mean, yes, well-known now, but I'm guessing not overly well-known at the time. And you introducing these brands into the UK, was anybody else doing this at that time? Was anyone else creating umbrella brands?
There were a few people in the very early days, but in the very early days, 1975, I started Woodhouse. There really wasn't much. There was Cecil G, but they were really kind of almost typified the generation before me. There was Jones. No, it was Quincy, Stuart Molloy, who went on to start Jones as well. There was a company called Just Men. There was a few people doing a little bit more interesting, but it was a very small business. And you have to remember at the time, someone like Selfridges was really an old school shop. It was like, are you being served? If you go into if you went to the ground floor, it would be selling, you know, sort of old-fashioned underwear and knicker elastic, and So anyway, I started this shop, and within about, it was almost successful almost straight away, and I got some great publicity from the Evening Standard for the knitwear that I was selling, and they did a double page spread on the shop, and that was 6 months after I opened it. So it became very successful, and then I opened in fairly quick succession another two or three shops over the next couple of years, another one in Oxford Street. So that sort of brings you up to
the speed,
the speed of where Woodhouse started anyway.
So when the 60s, people say like the 60s was kind of the high time, especially for retail, obviously London being the epicenter for that with Carnaby Street and King's Road. When you dial your mind back to 60s, late 60s, are these fun memories for you? Is this kind of the nostalgia? Do you feel like, well, these were the peaks of retail and fashion at the time?
Well, yeah. I mean, first of all, it was a lot easier. Or appeared easier, maybe because we were the young people doing new and interesting things, and I suppose we were pioneering. And there was a small band of us that were people like, well, Paul Smith. I remember Paul Smith because he was an agent for a guy called Nigel Caborn, who's still around as a, you know, great brand. And Paul Smith bought Nigel Caborn to me, so we ended up buying it for the Squire shop where I worked and that group. What was the question again?
it's more of, I guess, getting the feel of it. I mean, were you
at, oh yeah, the 60s.
Were you around, like, for example, when the likes of the Apple store was opening up and the huge mosaic was going up on the side of buildings, and then consequently, I guess, the downfall, getting it painted over again, you know, things like that.
I was based in the King's Road, but I mean, all of that. I mean, I had a girlfriend that she was a clothing designer. She worked for a company called Blades, which was Mayfair. So you've got in Mayfair, you've got Mr. Fish, got Tom Gilby, people like that doing interesting things for a different market. King's Road, there was tons of things going on. You could be a hip, you know, you could be in a tribe, of course, and there was a shop. So you could be a hippie, you could be glam, you could be you know, a teddy boy, you could be sort of whatever tribe you wanted. There was a shop for you.
Yeah.
So it was a heady mixture of hard work and working and enjoying what we did, because it was, you know, didn't feel like work. And I suppose all the interesting people that were around at the time. So yeah, it was, yeah. I mean, I lived near the King's Road, so I really sort of lapped up the whole time.
And in my mind, I guess, in my kind of my fantasy world, I imagine you and the likes of Paul Smith and Rupert Lysett Green, you're all in a WhatsApp group together sharing photos of times gone by. Is that, do you stay in touch with any of the old brands and the founders back in them days?
Well, I mean, I know Paul Smith, so, you know, I mean, we're not close friends, but we're friends and bump into each other, say hi. Yeah, I mean, I know most of the people that were around. I used to know the Browns people very well. I mean, I knew most of them, you know. Some of the, are they around? Most of them are not around anymore. there's a few. I'm trying to, well, Paul's still around, of course. Yeah. And Nigel Caborn's still around. You know, there are a few people that still work, especially if they were a bit younger than me. Yeah, it was a great time. I think the thing that you probably miss more than anything from that is the tribes, is the fact that you could have your look and you could work within that tribe. And there were lots and lots of different tribes.
Right.
Some of them quite aggressive, you know, that went on to be punks. Some of them sort of bother boys that wore braces and hobnail boots. But somehow that was the charm of it all. And then the next one would be a hippie or, you know, as I say, a glam rock, all sorts of people.
Have you ever written a book?
No, have not.
Have you ever thought about it?
Well, passing thought.
Because, I mean, we spoke off mic about how many people can relive some of these days through images and perhaps other books, but not everyone, in fact, very few people have actually lived for it and have these stories. So I think it's very important for these memories and tales to be preserved and passed on.
Okay. Well, it's part of British fashion history. And I'm lucky that I'm that the age where I remember, even when I was too young, really, sort of 10, 11, where the sister of a friend of mine who might be 5 or 6 years older was a beatnik, or was a teddy boy, and I was a fraction older, too young for those. And of course it went along with the music. I mean, the music that was new music that was coming along all the time. So
yeah. Well,
interesting.
Thank you for indulging me with nostalgia and the memories.
Okay.
Let's move on. Tell me a little bit about Mr. Star and when did that actually launch?
Well, the history of Start and Mr. Start, because I'll just tell you quickly. I used to live in West London and I last lived in Notting Hill. And my wife and I got a bit bored with Notting Hill. It was just become a bit too much Notting Hill for its own good. And I always wanted to live in a big loft space. So we decided to move. So I found a big loft space, or actually my wife found it, and where I still live. I mean, I've been here 20 years. And so we ended up in Shoreditch. And about the same time, I ended up out of work. I'd left the last project I had been involved in, which was working with then SRG, who then bought the tail end of Woodhouse out in about 2000. And I worked with them for a while, running Woodhouse for them. And when that fell apart, in not particularly nice way, but it fell apart, I didn't have anything to do. So my wife said to me, "Do you know, Philip, there's nowhere to shop around here." So I said, "Well, let's open a shop." So 2002, we opened a shop in the Shoreditch Triangle, which around then, there was nothing around there. I mean, everyone thought we were mad to open a shop there. Anyone that knows the Shoreditch Triangle in year 2000, it was just a desert. There was no footfall. I didn't know even if people much lived there, but somehow had an inkling that it was worth a crack. So we opened a shop 2002, and believe it or not, from the first day it was successful. People came, you know, it's one of those things, you know, build it and they will come. And so I started off with one shop, a menswear and ladies shop, and my wife and I ran it together, you know, really as like a mum and pop shop. So after having worked in a big chain, you know, run a big chain of shops, multi-million pound turnover, we're back to struggling to see if we can take £10,000 a week, which, funnily enough, we did. Anyway.
And this is pre-internet as well. Sorry to interrupt. This is 2002. I'm guessing there's no online landscape for you guys. So
no internet.
That's some serious numbers for, like you're saying, a place that has no footfall, has never been known for, I guess, fashion or retail or anything like that to be doing those kind of numbers. So
I mean it really was, there was literally nothing around, and I suppose that's what was interesting about it, because there was nothing around there. There were people that lived there, there were quite wealthy people, they were on the edge of the city, so there were a few people came up from the city, but it was mostly people that lived around in East London, and there weren't any shops. I mean, when I say there weren't any, there were zero shops. The only thing around there was Tommy Grun's, the hairdressers, which was then the sort of trendy Shoreditch hairdresser that gave everyone those cuts of hair, which I forget what they call them. There was a special Shoreditch something it was called. Anyway, they were the only people there. And if it hadn't been for them, I don't think I would have opened the shop there. It was just that there was just that glimmer of hope. Right. So we went on to... it was so successful, I thought, well, open another one. So I opened another shop across the road from it, because I thought, well, if they're going to come to this, they'll come to the other one. And we made that a ladies' shop. Now, I don't know if you ever went there to the ladies' shop, but it became a sort of art form for us. And we were famous for the creative displays, the windows. It was all pretty sort of crazy, and it was a little bit reminiscent of the 60s, where you could sort of kind of make it up as you went along. You didn't have to conform to any standard of the concept of the shop. And and we even had the pre Dover Street. We even had the Comme des Garçons people come down, including Mrs. Comme des Garçons herself, came down to look at the shop, and ended up employing the guy that I worked with, who was a sort of designer, finder of things, interesting maker of stuff, right, to do the Dover Street, the first Dover Street store. So we'd like to think there was a little bit of what we did there in the Dover Street concept, because we did used old shop fittings and crazy lights and all sorts of things.
Right.
So, but then you're talking of the internet. The internet scene started to emerge, and we found over the next few years, it was very successful probably for the first 5 years, but then you could start to see the writing on the wall. People became, I suppose, time poor, or had less time. And whilst as much as they loved coming to a destination shop, they, if they were busy, they'd go online. You know, maybe that Miu Miu sweater that they were looking for, they could find it online. They didn't have to come to the shop.
And what year are we talking about here now, Philip? So when you first start noticing the online presence kind of incepting people's...
I suppose 2008, 2009, 2010, around there.
Right. Okay.
That sort of period, maybe a bit later. I mean, we had our own online shop, and we even were one of the first people to go on the Farfetch site. That's another part of, the history. And Farfetch was also good, and we had our own site, but we were never particularly good at it because it wasn't our... We hadn't grown up with it. It was something we had to learn from what was already going on. So we had a shop, an online shop, and as I say, it was reasonably successful. And then in 2008, we started to do a little bit of tailoring in the men's store, and a shop became available again across the road. So we had three shops all next to each other on the opposite corner, and it was the shop I'd always loved, and I thought, I'm just going to buy that shop. So I bought the shop, I bought the lease for the shop, and I didn't really know what I was going to do with it. I had a few ideas, and then tailoring was emerging as sort of more of a fashion statement. There was a new feel and a look about tailoring, and so I decided that I'd open the tailoring shop. So I'd always been involved in tailoring all through the Woodhouse days. We always sold suits. I always was interested, always had helped, design suits and created them, chosen the fabric. So I knew all about that sort of part of it. And so we found a maker that we had worked with a little bit previously. And we designed, I designed a suit with skinny lapels and a little bit short fitting and slim, one button fit, slim trouser, and filled the shop up with it. And again, it was the first day we opened without any publicity. I'm pretty sure we took £4,000 or £5,000.
Wow, that's amazing.
Completely out of the blue.
Terrific.
I don't know where the people came from. And it became super successful. Again, so skinny suits, shirts, narrow ties. It was pretty much only that. We did had a made to measure. I knew nothing about made to measure at all. I'd never been involved in it, only ready to wear. So although I didn't work in the shop particularly at that time because I was running all the other shops, I knew I had to learn a little bit about it, which, as I said, I didn't know before. And there's another story about the tailoring a bit later, and it was successful. Other people came, even my old people that I worked with at SRG, which was Discount Suiting, as you probably may know, they came sniffing around to have a look, all sorts of people. And we did, you know, we had a very, very good business.
That's circa 10 years ago now. Would you say that the style has changed? I mean, skinny suits and skinny styles that can suppress silhouette was very much in vogue at that time, especially around 2012. I started to really notice that. Have you actually fluctuated your style with what's going on now? Have you always stuck to that silhouette?
No, well, the original suit, which we call the Rivington, the original silhouette still exists, and it's still a very good seller. The main feature is those things you just pointed out, with a very slim lapel. We've adapted a little bit. We've softened the shoulders a little bit, but really we've changed almost nothing about it since we started, which was 2008 that was designed. But we now run two other models, which one is a slightly more classic model. I call it a West End suit. So it's the sort of suit you might find in Savile Row, but we've tweaked it a bit to give it a bit more attitude. And then we run another model, which is really what you'd call contemporary today, which is a much more flexible model. It's soft tailoring. You can wear it in lots of different ways. You can split it up and wear the jacket as a jacket or the trousers separately.
Right.
And so we've adapted it. But it's interesting that the original suit from 2008 still exists and still sells, and that we have customers that sort of swear by it.
Right.
And come back and back for it.
You said you had another tailoring story.
Well, the tailoring story is that, as I said, I didn't know anything about made to measure, and I'm not a tailor.
Right.
I'm a menswear designer and a retailer. But when we in 2016 we closed the whole business down. We decided to close the other part of the business down completely. We weren't going to close the Mr. Store store down, but in the end, I did close it down. We felt that it was just not worth continuing. I could see the writing on the wall with the internet,
right.
And before we were forced to get out, I thought, let's get out because it's not working anymore. It's too much like hard work.
Right.
So in the end, we ended up closing the Mr. Start store for 3 months. So to rethink it. And it was, I must say, it was quite traumatic to do that. It always sounds interesting. You close down a store, it's like it's a one-liner, but actually closing a store is quite hard work.
Yeah.
So when we restarted again, it was a much smaller team. It was really me working in the shop, which I hadn't really done before. And there was a made-to-measure business. Now, I knew nothing about made-to-measure, as I've said a few times. So I had to teach myself to become a tailor, which I did. So I taught myself, and I do the lion's share of the made-to-measure now. And I'm happy to say that I'm pretty good at it. And I have a lot of, happy customers. Rarely, when people come and collect their suits, there rarely is any alterations to do. There's no, people say, oh, when do I come and get my first fitting? And I say, well, come for your fitting, but we hope there's nothing to do. And more often than not, people walk out with that suit that doesn't need anything doing to it. So I'm sort of fairly proud of that fact.
Because that's testament to the suit or testament to that being made to measure and not a bespoke suit?
Well, it's testament to the process, but it's also it's also the skill of measuring someone and making sure it fits.
Yeah, yeah, interesting. Philip, about the brand now, I mean, people can visit the website, by the way, how it is at the moment, which is mr-start.com to check out the jackets that you've just described. There's a lot of you in there, which I think offers a great insight and some transparency to the brand. Was this always part of the plan? Or,
well, I suppose I didn't decide. I suppose I was pushed by other people. They always said, well, you know, you fit the suits well, you sort of got the look. I always thought, well, God, I'm just too old to do it. They don't want to see, you know, someone my age wearing tailoring or wearing the garments. But in the end, I sort of took it on. I started to do it. We always got good results from social media when I did it, better results than when you necessarily had a model, even though they're, you know, maybe better than me. And so it's just a role that I now take you know, I take ownership of. And I also do the videos as well. And if
I've seen that on the Instagram, yeah. Thank you for teaching me how to do pocket squares. It was much better than I have been doing.
Well, most of these things is really not trying too hard. Most people try quite hard to put a pocket square in. You just put it in and it is what it is. So that's what I do now. Yeah.
And do you enjoy this?
I've always enjoyed what I do. Yeah. I mean, as the people say, do you still enjoy your work? And I say, well, I like the good days, but who doesn't?
And Shoreditch now. So, I mean, how long have you lived in Shoreditch?
20 years.
So 20 years when you first came in. What do you think of the area now? And especially now that the landscape has changed so dramatically over the last couple of decades.
Well, when we first had our first shop in the early 2000s, I mean, a lot of our customers were DJs and people involved in music and art and artists. Of course, a lot of those people have disappeared. A lot of the clubs have gone from around there, really the really good ones. And so it's morphed into a completely different area. But it's a changing area. I mean, it's obviously been completely changed by the lockdown, but as has so many other places. But I like Shoreditch because it is changing all the time. And yes, it's not such a party scene kind of place that it was back then. But the people that live there now are more mature people by and large, probably because the property prices have now increased. Yeah. I think it's a wonderful area still. It's still got lots of interest and lots of potential. And I'm sure once we get out of this terrible situation that we all are, it will redevelop like fashion will, and like a lot of other things. We'll have to change its tune, have to look, feel, act differently from the way it is. And that's the challenge of life and challenge of business as well.
And I guess I'll end it. I don't want to end on a somber note, but I did want to ask you about lockdown and how you've adapted or how it's impacted you personally and the business. Maybe you can just give us a little window into that.
Well, I mean, obviously it was traumatic. We're coming up to nearly a year now since we closed the shop originally. I honestly thought that when we closed it down in March last year, we would probably never reopen. That would be the feeling. I just couldn't see how we could open. But the government has been, you know, reasonably generous. We've had money. We've had opportunities for the business to borrow money if it needs to at a fairly reduced rate. We've had the odd chance where we've been able to open. You have to pivot, and we had to pivot more online. And we're not really a type of business that online suits particularly. And tailoring has not been the flavor of the month for people to buy, but we do sell a lot of other things. So we're not strictly speaking a tailoring business 100%. We sell. We have a very good shirt business, a very good knitwear business, accessories business. So we've got other things that we can pivot to.
Yeah.
And we've spent money, time, and energy on the web shop. So that's what I do. You know, I do the videos for online. I write some of the copy. I've got a small company which is actually based in Sweden that does some of the marketing for me, right. And especially the more technical marketing. We make it work. We jog along. We keep our head above water, and now what I'm trying to do is pivot the business again so that when we come out of lockdown, we're not just perceived as solely a sort of work environment clothing outfitter, in other words, suits. That I believe that when we do come out of this, people will want to dress up a bit more. They won't want to wear their sweatpants to their favorite restaurant or anything like that. So I think that tailoring could have a little bit of a renaissance, but tailoring is going to adapt, and we have to adapt the product to meet that customer. And that's what I'm actually working on at the moment. So off behind the camera here, got a whole pile of stuff I'm working on ready for the factories and that I'm working with. So whilst it'll be a formalish look still, it's going to be a different look.
Where are these factories? Sorry to interrupt you, Phil. Where are these factories?
Well, the factories are all over the place. I mean, we make shirts in Poland and Lithuania. We buy the fabric from Italy, by and large. We make all our knitwear either in Italy, where we make the fine gauge, the very thin ones like this,
yeah,
or the slightly heavier ones we make in Scotland. Tailoring we make in Portugal. Also, we have a factory that works with a lot of Savile Row people that's in Mauritius. Yes. We still have a tie and scarf and handkerchief maker that makes in the UK. So all that's made. So there's a fair bit of stuff made in the UK still.
Right.
And there's a bit of a renaissance about that as well, making in the UK.
Yeah.
So all over the place.
I can't wait not only to get out, but one of the reasons why I really look forward to these interviews, not only to pick your brains, Philip, but also I get to wear a tie. I mean, I've got a whole drawer of ties. I've no idea how I've got into ties of the last couple of months, but it feels like the only excuse I really get to wear one is when I come on camera. But it's one of the few joys
I have. Let me just say something about ties. I mean, I know ties is the sort of thing that people feel they have to wear, but I think ties are really nice. You know, I think they look great on people. And again, I think something that you might see as a bit of a renaissance is that dressing up and feeling, putting a tie on, because an open neck shirt doesn't
not
quite cut
me.
It, does
not
it?
Not in my house. Anyway, Philip, it's been great talking to you, getting to know more about the brand and listening to some of those stories. Thanks for indulging me and taking the time out of your day. For people that want to visit the online store before we manage to get down to see Philip in person, it's mr-start.com, and also get those tutorials over on Instagram. He's _mr.start, but we'll put all the show notes over on the website so people can find you there. But in the meantime, thanks, Philip.
Enjoyed it.
Thank you, Philip. Well, quite the story, quite the legacy, and like I say, many people can talk about the 60s, but only few folk can talk about it from personal experience, and even fewer still left in the game and going strong. So Mr. Start, sir, we salute you. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Menswear Style Podcast. If you like what you hear, why not leave us a review? It does help our egos. Don't forget to check out the show notes for this episode and all content pertaining to watches, travel, lifestyle, fashion as well over at www.menswearstyle.co.uk, and we're on the social at Menswear Style. If you want to be a guest on the show and tell us about your brand and your journey, you can email us here at info@menswearstyle.co.uk. And until next time,